You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Wednesday, June 30th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Professor of Sustainable Development at the University of Surrey in the UK, author of Post-Growth, Life After Capitalism, Tim Jackson will be joining us. Also on the program today, the Trump Organization and its CFO are looking at criminal charges that are expected to drop tomorrow. Meanwhile, South Dakota rents its National Guard to a right-wing billionaire for work on the southern border. Democratic lawmakers urge Biden to extend the freeze on student loan payments to March of 2022. And at one point, will it be untenable to unfreeze? Meanwhile, Pennsylvania state prisoners go on a hunger strike. Protest. Form of solitary confinement. Nina Turner's Ohio 11th primary bid is shaping up to represent a huge threat to the Democratic establishment. The Northwest record heat wave has now taken the lives of dozens of people. New York's mayor's race tabulation in total disarray. We think we have a notion of who might be possibly, potentially in the lead. Maybe. Meanwhile, Moderna says its vaccination is effective versus the Delta variant, as Fauci foresees a tale of two Americas. Vaxxed and unvaxxed. Lastly, Ilhan Omar, whip for the Progressive Caucus, says the Progressive Caucus is ready to flex its muscles over the infrastructure reconciliation bill. All this and much, much more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for joining us. A couple of moments of house cleaning, if you will indulge me. Housekeeping, house cleaning. Emma Vigeland is on special assignment to examine the report on her own vacation, and she will be back next week on Tuesday. Also, want to apologize for yesterday. We had a major, massive, catastrophic internet fail, and this show, both the guests and our ability to broadcast it, and even to... right now, in the way that we're recording it in studio to even record,
still don't fully trust it. But
yes, well, we fixed it up with duct tape, and we have folks coming tomorrow to check it out. So I just wanted to apologize. We had no show yesterday for those folks who were looking for the show and couldn't find it. I also want to apologize to Steven Crowder and his dad. I think they were very freaked out when we announced that we had internet problems. I'm sure that was in some way triggering to them, and I want to apologize for that. We did not mean to do so. Also, along those lines, tomorrow we're going to have to start early as well. And that, again, for the Crowders, please do not freak out. It is just, honestly, I've got a doctor's appointment I've got to get to, and so we're going to start a little bit early. And that's it. I just don't want anybody to freak out. So
Also, Emma's not tracking you down either. She's actually on vacation, Stephen.
That's right. Emma is actually on vacation. She's not going to, you know, ambush you and, you know, make you run away from a debate. That's not going to happen. Just want to make that absolutely clear. Some interesting stuff in the infrastructure that is out. There was a piece in Politico today that highlighted something that Joe Biden had said about the bipartisan infrastructure deal. Now, right now, the Democrats are in a mode in which, and particularly Joe Biden, is in a mode in which he wants to salvage the bipartisan deal. And so that he can salvage the 50 votes necessary for a reconciliation deal. These two things are going to run in parallel. We have talked about them as being supplemental in some respects. The reconciliation bill, providing funding in for the bipartisan bill that didn't go far enough. For example, the support for electric vehicles provision. I can't remember the specific numbers off the top of my head, but I think going into it, the Democrats wanted, let's say, 100,000 EV stations around the country. I think it was probably closer to 65. And the bipartisan deal only provides 15,000. Don't hold me to these numbers. I don't have them right in front of me. The point is the dynamic. The White House has said and made a pledge that nothing in the reconciliation bill will add to the specific silos in the bipartisan bill. So in other words, you could provide in the reconciliation bill, hypothetically, $400 billion worth of solar panels or subsidies, just hypothetically. But according to the pledge that Biden has made to the bipartisan voting block, there will be no more funding for EV stations. Now, there may be ways that the Democrats in their reconciliation bill get around this so that it's not technically adding to the specific line item or silo. For instance, rural broadband. I think Biden wanted $65 billion, and I think they ended up doing maybe $20 billion. You could not then add another $45 billion, theoretically, to rural broadband. But who knows what you could call it at that point. You could create a different program. But it is an important understanding to know when you start to talk about the politics that are involved in this. They need to argue that the bipartisan bill is a limiting principle, if you will, so that it will hopefully pass, and the value of it passing is to get Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema's votes on the reconciliation bill, because it is the members of the House and some members of the Senate has said, we're not voting for one if we don't get both. And so the deal here is deliver the bipartisan bill. Sinema and Manchin will then vote theoretically for the reconciliation bill. And that's the way this is going to work. But for there to be value to the bipartisan bill, Republicans need to be able to say, hey, we prevented an extra $40 billion to rural broadband. It's another question altogether as to why that would have value to them. But that's the way that that's where they find their value. So understand the sort of delicate interplay here. When Biden says this is a limiting principle and gives the opportunity for some of those Republicans who are on board with this in that gang of 10, talking points, it makes it harder for Mitch McConnell to scuttle that bill. You can pass it with 55 if McConnell says, we're not going to do a filibuster. And of course, if they do the filibuster, then the hand of people who want to reform the filibuster and argue against the position that Joe Manchin has taken, they are strengthened. So it's a very interesting interplay that's going on here. And the bottom line of it is, if it works out, we could be looking at the largest expansion or stimulus infrastructure investment in soft infrastructure that we have seen in this country. I don't know, maybe ever in one bill. I mean, we're talking about the potential of $5 or $6 trillion worth of spending. That's extraordinary. But we're a ways off for it for actually happening. Here is an example of the dilemma that the Republicans have here. And it actually is provided to us by Fox, or the Fox 5. Is that what they call it? The 5. They now have a new liberal punching bag on that show. Her name is Jennifer Tarlove. I don't know much about her, frankly. She is replacing Juan Williams. I don't know if she's actually permanently replaced him or just today. And she, I don't know if this was her intent, shows the dilemma that Republicans have. You already have a gang of 10 that has signed off on an infrastructure, bipartisan infrastructure bill. Mitch McConnell doesn't know what to do. He's saying if it's untethered from the reconciliation bill, then he will allow it to go forward. But the Republicans have no substantive argument against this bipartisan bill. Look how lame their talking points are against this. Tarlove is going to cite the tragedy that has happened in Miami Beach. Or excuse me, not Miami Beach, in Florida. And on the coast of Florida. We have dozens, over 100 people, more than likely dead in this collapse of a building that I am sure was a function of faulty building practices. But also, I would imagine a function, at least in part, of increased water through the very porous ground that things on the coast of Florida are built on, rising ocean levels. In other words, climate change.
My understanding was it was built on a reclaimed wetland or swamp.
And those reclaimed wetlands are becoming more and more wet because of rising sea levels, particularly in southern Florida and throughout the coastal Florida. And so there are multiple things that are working. I don't know if we'll ever know it was 75% this, 25% that. But so with that understanding, listen to the talking points that the five have developed against the idea of infrastructure.
And rescue package, this is a core component of the American Jobs Act. And Mitch McConnell said over the weekend, if the reconciliation bill isn't necessarily tied to this, Republicans should be for this. Everybody wants infrastructure. And certainly Republicans that are in states with crumbling bridges. We have a crumbling building in Florida now that,
unrelated. It's a private building.
I understand. I'm just saying there are disasters all around.
But it's not like part of infrastructure plan.
Okay. I'm not saying it's going to fund Surfside. I'm just saying that people are surrounded by things that are broken, and Republicans and Democrats want to fix them.
You know what else is crumbling? Your ivory tower.
Really.
Crashing down.
My degrees are in great shape right now.
Money.
But putting aside the private versus public infrastructure issue, Joe Biden has gotten what he wanted. And I think we all remember when the squad was like, oh, I don't know if we're going to vote for Nancy Pelosi as speaker. And then they all lined up and they voted for Nancy Pelosi
as
speaker.
That is true.
They fall in line. And Bernie Sanders has also fallen in line throughout his entire 50-year curmudgeonly career. So
now, let's just reserve the last sort of points that she has to make to sort of position herself appropriately on the Fox 5. But the idea that having a building collapse doesn't remind people the potential dangers that exist if we do not upgrade our infrastructure That's the low-hanging fruit of her comment. It is just creating a political context where it's not hard to say, like, hey, it's important to invest in these things. It's important to go in and check the structural soundness of our infrastructure. Never mind the fact that we're talking about addressing climate change in this, which undoubtedly impacted Surfside and undoubtedly impacts a myriad of other things. We have roads buckling in the Northwest. We have scores of people dying in the Pacific Northwest because of the heat. We have droughts. We have shortages of crops. We have superstorms. I mean, all of this, it seems quite obvious, you know, even to people who are just maybe you got to be number 6 or 7 on the 5 to really get that. But the idea that they're going to say, well, egghead, I think people who don't have advanced degrees understand the implications of poor infrastructure.
This feels like the future. Like, this is going to be their reaction to everything. We're going to see images of things collapsing because of climate change or like, you know, forest fires caused by climate change. It's going to be like, oh, you egghead.
We are in a very bizarre moment where the right has always deployed the culture war as a mechanism to fight against policies. But now they're not even doing that. Right. They're not even confronting the idea of the infrastructure bill there. They're just going on like we're going to wage our culture war. And fine, if you want to pursue the policies, we're going to concede on that on some level. There is no policy argument from the right now. It is almost exclusively culture war stuff. And they will deploy it at every moment. There used to be a time where the response would be, we can't spend that much. We can't, and you know, they would all be lies. The debt is exploding. The deficit's exploding. There would be some policy response. And now it's just, look at you, egghead. I mean, the point she was making was not that sophisticated. That it warranted, like, you gotta really feed this to people. It's not enough to cite the building that just collapsed 3 days ago and killed 100 people.
Like, maybe we should do something about our private infrastructure too.
Yes. Or maybe what we need is more regulation so that a building that gets cited in 2018, 3 years later, hasn't done anything about it, cannot continue to function in that way until it collapses. And then, of course, she goes on in the end to say that they all fell in line. Well, I don't think that there was actually a real movement to not vote for Pelosi for speakership, or to the extent that there was. Remember PAYGO? The diminishment of PAYGO as a principle of operation for the House. Well, we're about to see a $5 or $6 trillion worth of potentially of spending that have allowed that to go through without the words PAYGO even being sort of brought up by the Democrats in the House. And Bernie Sanders was responsible for something, let's say the ACA for community medical centers that are a huge linchpin of the success, to the extent that there is success with the ACA. Not so great in keeping prices down on insurance, but very good in terms of its Medicaid expansion, and it's providing for some, filling in some of the gaps. The best parts of the ACA were the single payer qualities of it that existed for, sadly, only a limited amount of people. But there it is. The five presenting us today a good inadvertent illustration of what's going on in Congress in many respects. It's really just like even the lawmakers, the Republican lawmakers, are just deploying the culture war. They're doing push-ups. They're talking about Q and... But we will get more into that later in the program. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, We'll be talking to Tim Jackson, director of the Center for Understanding Sustainable Prosperity and the professor of sustainable development at the University of Surrey, author of his latest post-growth, Life After Capitalism. Just a couple of words from our sponsor today. Our sponsor today is, oddly enough, the Majority Report merch store. That was very nice of them. We're going to take the chair of that, the CEO of that that institution out to dinner. Oh, we should all have. Actually, we're going to go. We're planning a finally doing our holiday. For our 2019 holiday party. Folks, check out our merch store. It is shop.majorityreportradio.com. You will see the Oh No, It's Sam Cedar, What an Effing Nightmare shirt. You will see the black tank top. And just an update, that's the Effing Nightmare shirt. We have a black and white tank top, and I have made the pledge that if we get to 100 sales of those, I will wear one on the show, maybe on a casual Friday. It's going to be highly inappropriate, but I'll do it. And we are at like 54 now between the black and the white. And then you see we got mugs, we got bandanas, we got the beanies. I love that. The gray beanie is actually great. You get it now before winter and then before the rush happens. So check that out. Also, just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can go to jointhemajorityreport.com, become a member of the show. We cannot do it without you. You guys allow us a certain level of independence that annoys a whole host of people. I can tell you that right now. From people that we license the show to advertisers, media brokers who say, why won't you advertise for this? Because we don't like that product or we don't believe in that sector or whatever it is. Or we just won't do this. And they're like, well, you know, what are you going to do? And we're going to rely on our members. So you can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Don't forget, like and subscribe. And also, the AM Quickie is now officially on hiatus. We're hoping to bring it back in September. But if you want to be, if you want to know what's happening with the AM Quickie, if we bring it back, go sign up for our newsletter at majority.fm. We are going to be rolling out a newsletter soon. And that's it. Also, so want to welcome to the program. Welcome to the program. Tim Jackson, he's the director of the Center for Understanding Sustainable Prosperity. He is the professor of sustainable development at the University of Surrey in the UK, author of Post-Growth, Life After Capitalism. This is a follow-up to his well-received and broadly cited book, Prosperity Without Growth. Welcome to the program, Tim.
Thanks, Sam. Great to be here.
So let's start with this book in relationship, Post-Growth, Life After Capitalism. Where does it pick up where Prosperity Without Growth leaves off?
Yeah, good question. In a way, it's almost as much a prequel as it is a sequel. So Prosperity Without Growth was actually written in my role as Economics Commissioner for the UK Sustainable Development Commission. So it was basically a report to government, a report to the Prime Minister. So it's full of, you know, stats and figures and graphs and arguments about economics that hopefully policymakers would understand. And although at the time, actually, interestingly, the government wasn't too pleased to hear from one of their advisors questioning economic growth, that book had this, as you said, it had this huge audience of people who did think that was a kind of important question, you know, what kind of economy we have on a finite planet. And so in the aftermath of that work, you know, it became, as you said, a very, you know, very well-known, well-cited book. And I suppose I kind of felt that it wasn't, you know, written in the style that ordinary people might easily pick up and enjoy. So I wanted to write something really for those people, for that audience that I never expected for Prosperity Without Growth, but who actually found it a really important topic, and to write it in a way that they could understand, to put story into it, to put narrative into it, to put the example of other people's lives into it, and to really make that case in a way that, you know, that ordinary people could get to grips with and enjoy reading about.
And ultimately, it is a, if not a roadmap, I guess, a vision of what life would be like if we weren't so oriented towards constant growth.
That's right. I mean, that's kind of has been our model forever, that sort of vision. More and more is better and better. That's the mantra of growth, the myth of growth. And that's what I'm questioning in the book. And I'm also, I suppose I'm, you know, it's a vision of that better life that might come after our mantra of growth. But it's also a kind of invitation to a conversation. What sort of life do we want? What sort of society do we want? What kind of economy could make that work? And it's a set of resources in the sense that, you know, I use examples of a lot of people who had that kind of vision. Sometimes, you know, only a few years ago, like Greta Thunberg, sometimes a few decades ago, like Robert Kennedy, sometimes a couple of millennia ago, like the Chinese sage Lao Tzu. And I bring these voices together in a way that sort of says, yeah, we think capitalism and that mantra of always having more, that's the way it's always been. And it's not. And it's not the way it always has to be. There's a kind of, you know, it's an invitation. Is there something better afterwards? And my answer and the answer of quite a lot of those people is, yeah, we could have something better.
And I should say, it's also months ago. It also was relevant months ago. I think for a lot of people during COVID, one of the things, and I just want to put a pin in that for a moment, and we'll circle back around that. But let's talk about the myth of growth. I mean, you cite RFK talking about the paradigm that we have in the or. We had at that time in the United States, which has not changed, frankly. And I want to, you know, at that time it was the GNP, I think it was, and now it's we refer to it as the GDP, the gross domestic product. What expand a little bit on what the myth, not just the myth, but what that paradigm is in terms of growth. Why it is so, why it's considered so necessary from a capitalistic perspective, but also how that translates into our daily lives in which we perceive it as being necessary. Because I don't feel like a lot of people walk around with the idea of like, we need growth. I just don't think that they, that's a concept that is like colloquial in some way. Like, but what is the colloquial version of that of buying into that paradigm?
It's really interesting you should say that. And I cite this story in the book. But when we in the UK were going through this big vote about whether we wanted to stay in the EU or not, the European Union or not, and you know, the Brexit vote, as it was called, and a lot of government politicians turned up at local meetings trying to persuade people to vote to stay in the European Union. And they would sort of say, look, if we don't stay in the European Union, it's going to have a bad impact on the GDP. And one of these meetings, a woman stood up in the audience and said, you know, that's your bloody GDP. It's not ours. In other words, it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with our lives. We don't understand it. We don't figure what it is. It doesn't tell us a story. And that's, you know, one of the problems is it's an indicator that doesn't necessarily always speak to people, but it does have a sort of a, you know, an everyday currency, which is our salary going up or is our salary going down? And that, you know, that begins then to speak to the sharp end. It begins to sort of have an impact on people's lives. And certainly, you know, for the poorest in society, we would want to have a world in which salaries could be decent, and in particular in which the people who provide the most fundamental aspects of our economy, the nurses, the care workers, the doctors, the teachers, the people who make sure that we have food on our table, we don't want them to be below the poverty line. We want those incomes to rise. And so there's a point to which growth makes sense for the poorest in society. But there's also a sense in which actually in modern society, we kind of have sometimes too much. And you know, there are extremely, some people would say obscenely rich people in the world. And there are also diseases of that affluence. You know, the World Health Organization has pointed out that actually more people die in the world of overconsumption than die of malnutrition in the sense of not having enough. And that's an extraordinarily, it's a sort of indictment really of a system that's gone wrong. Yes, having more makes sense when you don't have enough. But at a certain point, enough is enough. And actually, we should be thinking about redistributing the wealth in the world a little bit better, about protecting our planet, and also thinking, you mentioned the pandemic, what really matters to us? What is it that prosperity is about? What does the good life consist in? And it's rarely the case, actually, that it consists in just having more and more.
And so, in other words, the growth, the pie should not grow larger. What should there's certain slices of the pie should grow larger. But the pie
Be distributed better.
Should stay. And so, okay, so I mean, it's interesting because there was, and maybe I'll circle back to this too. But I recall in the early 90s, at least in this country, as the wall fell with the Soviet Union, that there was talk of a peace dividend, which really never terribly materialized, at least in this country, in any real meaningful and sustainable way. But there was also a movement to recalculate the GDP. I can't recall if it was the GDP at that time or the GNP. And so the people understand. Explain to people what the GDP measures, because I don't like the GDP. If somebody breaks into my studio now and steals the cameras and I get to spend the day going out and buying new cameras, the GDP goes up. But it doesn't. I mean, doesn't make me any more productive in any way. But will you explain what it is?
Yeah, I mean, it's even worse than that in a way. Even your fear that someone's going to break in and steal your cameras means you take out a big insurance policy, and that's going to make the GDP go up as well. So the less secure society is, the better it is for the GDP. GDP is really a measure of, I guess we could just say, the busyness of our economy, how much production, how much being sold, how much is being spent on consumer goods. All those things have to match up in something called the system of national accounts. And the top measure of that, you know, that top measure of busyness, the measure of value added in society from the production of goods that we consume, that's what the GDP is. It's kind of, it's a very straightforward measure. It's quite a clever measure in a way. I'm not against it as a measure. It's just not a very good measure of us, of our welfare, of social progress. And that's exactly what Kennedy was pointing out 53 years ago.
And I want to circle back to the question of how maybe we might, or the value of the of perhaps like redefining how we calculate the GDP. Before we get there, let's talk about the idea of limitation and it enabling transcendence. I have to say this concept basically reminded me, as a function of my own background in filmmaking in the era in which I did it, of Dogma 95, which was the Vinterberg and I can't remember the other guy now off the top of my head, style of filmmaking, that they used video cameras and they wanted to use video cameras. But instead, what they did is they created a dogma that said you can only use natural lighting. You can only use you have to sync the audio cannot be recorded separately from the video. Or the picture, and it created essentially a new form of filmmaking because they had imposed narrow limits on it. And that's sort of the concept that you're talking about.
That's a fantastic example. It's not one that I was familiar with, but it's exactly what I'm talking about. You get to what looks like a limit, a constraint in your life, and you have a couple of choices. The most obvious ones are, am I going to power up and bust through that limit because I refuse to accept limits? And the other one is, of course, you're going to cower in a corner and say, no, I'm giving up now, I've had enough. And actually, it's not a very good idea to teach your kids to do either of those things, because there are other options. You kind of look at that limit and you say, what is it teaching me? What is it teaching me about the physical nature of the world? And what can it teach me about my capabilities? And that's the thing, where I really want to, what I wanted post-growth to do was to say, actually, this question of limits and the planetary limits is there. It is real. We can't deny the record-breaking temperatures on the west coast of Canada any longer. Joe Biden can't deny them any longer. That's coming at us. And we have a couple of choices. We can sort of say, don't believe it, going to go away and hide in a hole somewhere. Or we can say, what is that teaching us about what prosperity can possibly mean on a finite planet? And learn, actually, that we have other capabilities that aren't just about consuming stuff and burning energy, that we have the ability to relate to each other. That's something that can grow and grow forever without any limit. So the limits teach us, if you like, the root. They are the route to the limitless. Where the physical limits are tells us where our creativity can actually thrive without limits. And it sort of points us in that direction. If we take it seriously, if we take that choice seriously, say, I'm not going to hide in a corner and pretend this isn't here. I'm not going to bust through it and power through it with the biggest technology I've got. I'm going to take this moment to learn what this limit is teaching me about how to be a better human being, what these limits are teaching us about how to be a better society.
Talk about the false promises that are inherent in capitalism and why growth is so essential to capitalism. What, or why these things cannot be severed, that relationship can't be severed.
Yeah, I mean, the two different questions, really, both absolutely pivotal questions. I mean, let's take that one first. Why is that so difficult to sever? And, 150 something years ago, Marx was writing, accumulate, that is Moses and the prophets. That's what capitalism is all about. And there is a sense in which that mantra of always having more is built into this idea that profit is what makes the world go round. Profit is the only thing that motivates us. And that profitability, that profit-seeking behavior, that profit-maximizing behavior just has no boundaries whatsoever. It kind of casts us as insatiable people, and it casts the economic system as a kind of struggle, a war of all against all, in which, the more you have, the better off you are. The more power you have, the better it is for tomorrow. The more you invest in the future, then the bigger your bank account is going to be. And that's the logic that's kind of bedded down in capitalism. And its promise is that everybody can have that, that we can all be Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk. We can all be billionaires. We can all one day be as rich as those people are. And that will be a good thing for all of us. And really, both of those promises are wrong. There's no way that the earth can sustain the kind of wealth that the richest people on the planet have at all. And indeed, even if it did, is that really a world in which our lives are better, in which we have become better people, in which our society is better, in which we treat each other better? Is it a kinder society? Is it a more creative society? Does it have better poetry? Does it have any kind of vision for itself beyond that more and more? And it purports, capitalism says, if you buy my dream, then I will make you happy. But there's an even more curious reality underlying that happiness, isn't what capitalism is really driven on. Capitalism promises that you can be happy if you buy this next thing. This next thing will make you happy. But actually, capitalism needs you not to be happy, because if you're happy with that next thing, you're not going to go out looking for the one after, and the one after that, and the one after that. So what capitalism actually needs, and why it's such a false promise, is it needs you to be unhappy. It needs you to be constantly dissatisfied. It needs you to be that consumer who's gone out and bought a piece of junk and took it home and realized how crappy it was, and then thought, well, I'll go out tomorrow and buy another one. That's what capitalism thrives on, discontent rather than happiness. And that's why it's a false promise.
And is there a level, you talk about this, I think, in terms of like developing countries, right? And $15,000, I think it was, you said, and if I can't remember if it was $15,000 or pounds, but there is a number that, and because as you're saying this, capitalism needs you to feel unfulfilled, because that way it spurs you to fulfill yourself by buying. It needs to tell you that you smell, so you go out and you buy antiperspirant, et cetera, et cetera. But some people could say, I do smell, and I don't like the smell, and I want some antiperspirant. So where is the sort of, where is that stasis? And is it something that we have surpassed a long time ago in some of the developing countries, but there are some countries where that level, there is a sweet spot, right? Mm. And where is that sweet spot, at least, or how do we assess that?
Yeah, I mean, you can't be absolutely simplistic about it because they're very poor people in very rich countries, and you can never forget that. But if you look across countries, the data is fairly straightforward, actually. It suggests, as you say, there's a kind of sweet spot. When you've got nothing, having a bit more makes a real, real difference. It makes that it almost doubles your life expectancy as you go from nothing at all to around about that figure of $15,000 per capita. That's what happens to life expectancy across those poorest countries. As you increase their income, you increase the life expectancy, and you couldn't get more basic than life expectancy. You know, do you want to live 42 years as you do in some sub-Saharan Africa countries, still in the poorest parts of the world? Is it a nice thing to contemplate that you might have a healthy life into your 80s? Of course it is. That's something worth striving for. And when you look at the data, that's what you see. You see prosperity increasing as you get up to about that $15,000, $20,000 per capita mark. And then you see it do a really weird thing, which is just begin to diminish the impact of the good impact of that increase in income until it's almost flat as you go up to very rich countries like the US and the UK, and sometimes even tips downwards, so that you're worse off from being richer in terms of some of these basic indicators of health, of longevity, of infant mortality, of our participation in education, even happiness. And when you look across the world at the statistics, that's kind of what it shows. It shows there is a sweet spot, and that sweet spot is, as you say, is around about that $20,000 per capita mark.
I think that there's been some data in the U.S. that's I think it was Dan Price who was a CEO of a company. I can't remember exactly what it was, that basically cut his pay so that he could pay everyone $70,000 in that neighborhood. And that was found to be the number in the United States that you have peak, I guess, prosperity, in the sense that you are both content with your quality of life, but you have enough money that it helps your quality of life, as opposed to at one point starting to inhibit your quality of life. I don't know if that ties up, but speaking.
Yeah, I mean, just on the numbers, and we shouldn't pay attention so much to particular numbers without understanding the background. So one of those numbers is a number that, you know, everybody might have who is working. Another is a number that everybody has when you divide the entire income across all the population, including kids and grandparents and people who aren't working. And so, you know, you have to take them very seriously, but you also have to look at what the impact of those numbers is in terms of the amount of goods and services, the energy we're consuming, the impact that has on the planet. And that also comes out in the mix, because ultimately, if you're trashing the boundaries of the planet, then you're undermining the security of your kids into the future. And that's a real consideration.
Let's talk about the reassessment of work and what you called world building. There was a piece today by, I think it was Robert Kuttner in the American Prospect. I'm not sure you're familiar with it in this country. Mm-hmm. He cites a book from decades ago that escapes me at the name, but it Voice and oh gosh, I can't remember. But the argument is essentially that there is, it's Hirschman, that exiting the workforce, or you can express yourself by not doing certain things, and that over the course of this pandemic, there has been a reassessment of, you know, some people saying, like, the amount that I was making for that crappy ass job was just simply not worth it, you know, relative to the time I get to spend with my kids, or I don't need as much as I thought I did, and therefore I'm not going to go work. The coercive power of work is has been diminished because people have reassessed what it's bringing them, at least in terms of their specific jobs. But you talk about your vision of a reassessment of work.
Yeah, I mean, I think I want work to be taken seriously as a part of our lives, not as that coercive force, not as, you know, being on the treadmill and having to spend hours of our lives away from our family, sitting on crowded trains with everybody else who's doing the same thing in order to bring home enough money to do it again tomorrow. You know, that is not a meaningful vision of work. But I draw here on a philosopher called Hannah Arendt, and I distinguish, I suppose, two different kind of tasks that we do in the world. One of them, you know, it's really important. It's about caring for each other. It's about looking after our kids. It's about, you know, the care that we have in hospitals. It's about the care we needed all the way through the pandemic. And actually all the people who were engaged in that task, treated so badly by capitalism, underpaid, insecure jobs, forever hounded by productivity targets to keep them going. And it's also a job that sometimes is not paid at all. So, you know, the people, sometimes our time looking after our kids, why is that not a value to society? Of course it is, because we're caring for the people that we love, and we're also caring for the members of our society who make that society stronger. And so all of these things about around care, really, around maintenance of our lives and looking after ourselves and care, they tend to be badly treated by capitalism. And I think they should be better treated. I think the people who work in those professions should be better treated. They're meaningful tasks. And as you say, when push comes to shove and we're given a sort of object lesson on what really matters to us, those were often the tasks that we return to. And they're absolutely primitive. They almost belong to our primitive brains, because they belong to every species on the planet that needs to, you know, survive, to care for the young, to maintain ourselves, to look after ourselves. And then Hannah Arendt does a really interesting thing. She kind of says, you know, as we free ourselves, so-called free ourselves from all those tasks, we look up and we face something we didn't really expect to see there, which is the prospect of our own mortality. You know, when we're busy doing that, looking after, and then, you know, I can certainly sympathize. I can understand this. You know, when you're immersed in looking after your kids, for example, you may not say I'm happy, but you know that you're occupied. And actually, when you look back on it later in your life, that sense of being 100% occupied in that task is something that has a real value to you, even decades later. But when we look up from those tasks and what we see is, oh, my goodness, you know, I'm going to die. That's the reality of my life. I've got all this time on my hands, and all I'm doing is worrying about the fact that those around me are dying and I'm going to die one day, and I've got to get all this done, and I've got to make something meaningful out of my life. So we're faced with this task, and this is what Arendt means by world building, the world building task of work. We're faced with the idea that we want to build something a little bit more durable, a little bit something that will last into the future, something that will give a sense of our own significance in society and the significance of society to the future. And so that world building task, I would argue, is also incredibly important. And some of the things that we're asked to do, you know, people who are literally building physical environments and more shopping centers and bigger Trump towers and what have you, that's a kind of part of what they're engaged in, is that fear of mortality. They're trying to put something solid in place. And yet, once again, kind of capitalism comes into town and says, well, you know, I don't want that to last too long. Because if it lasts too long, there's not enough other building to be done. And if we don't have other people building, we can't grow. And so, you know, it's more about building so we can destroy it in the future, so that we can build again. And the whole thing becomes sort of meaningless. And what I guess my vision is to point towards that place where we can find the things to do that bind us as individuals into society, building that society together, but also point to a sense of a meaningful human progress, something into the future that capitalism can't knock down, that we don't need to knock down, that begins to, if you like, give us back our hope about what the future could be.
What is the human version of that obsolescence that you're referring to, right? I mean, the obsolescence being like, you know, we're going to build this building, but in 50 years, we're going to tear it down. We're going to build one that's three times as high. And then 50 years, we're going to build it, you know, et cetera, et cetera. What is the human version of that obsolescence? Is it just simply, is it regressive in the sense of like, well, we're going to increase the carceral state, or we're going to make sure that we have a consistent level of poverty, or where does that obsolescence come in? Does that make sense? The question.
Yeah, I mean that obsolescence comes in from capitalism kind of everywhere. I mean, I'm not sure your last point about poverty. I mean, I think that's a good goal to have. Let's reduce that.
Oh no, no, level of poverty. Capitalism needs to maintain
that
of anxiety as a way to something to ostensibly overcome.
Yeah, I mean, capitalism could never admit to sort of saying we're going to keep that level of poverty. But in a sense, that is where it kind of ends up, because, you know, if you want all these people to get rich in a world in which there isn't that much, that means someone's consigned to poverty. So there's a real human impact there. But there's also an impact, you know, in our everyday lives. So, you know, I've got a favorite example, which is in my hometown. And there's a DIY store, and you can go there and you can buy everything. And, you know, you see on Saturday crowds of people in there buying stuff. And you know that sooner or later, within a short space of time, that's got to fall apart. And sometimes, you know, it even falls apart as you're walking out of the door. But that's OK, because just next door is what's known euphemistically as the municipal recycling center, the dump. And so, you know, you've bought this piece of crap, you know, it's going to fall apart. But if you go there on that Saturday morning, you'll see a whole bunch of people also in the dump in the municipal recycling center, taking all that broken stuff there and all being busy. And they all have to have cars, and they have to all buy gas in order to get the cars to the DIY center and from the DIY center to the dump. And the whole thing is going round and round and round. And it's all obsolescent, because none of it is really speaking to the underlying needs that we have as human beings.
All right. So lastly, let me ask you this in terms of what of like the concept of green growth, right? I mean, if we were to take, the work you've done in post-growth and begin to apply it within the context of our society in a political way, right? As opposed to saying, you know, the concept of a post-growth world, but we say instead a green growth world, which essentially is a redistribution, right? Because we're no longer going to put our resources into the burning of fossil fuels, but we're going to put it into sustainable energy that ultimately is going to provide maybe less profit ultimately, because, you know, once you set up those panels, the sun is free. It's, you can't charge for that. You can charge, you know, for something for the panels, but once the panels are there, it's not, it is the sun keeps going. Same with wind and water. So what of those alternative movements that seek to, in some ways, just redefine the concept of growth?
Yeah, I think they're good. I mean, I think all those technologies are good. It might, you know, it might be interesting just to say that actually that's where I started. I started working on those technologies a long time ago, let's say. And I believe that in the power of those technologies, I think they're really important. And I think they're in some way an essential part of getting us out of the mess that we've got into. But I also think we have to kind of think beyond that. And I do think we have to think in particular about this more and more that we want to measure and have going higher and higher. And one of the things I talk about in the book, you know, you asked me about these measures before, and I think it's really important, is that there's a difference between, you know, thinking of prosperity as being about wealth, about having more and more, and thinking of prosperity as being about health and better and better. And health is a really interesting metaphor, because it doesn't really, never when you're looking at health do you want more and more of something. You only want more and more when there's not enough. And so what you end up thinking about when you think about prosperity as health rather than wealth is this sense of balance, of having things which are good at the right level for us, not always more and more, not always bigger and bigger, but a society that is deeper and richer, and its relationships are better, and its creativity is stronger, and its sense of community is more solid, and its hope for the future stays intact. And that really is, you know, that's the vision of post-growth, that there are things which we can have which are really a better society than the one we have at the moment, but we have to measure the right things. We have to focus on the right things. And we have to create the policies that will transform society that so that people can live better and richer lives.
What is the bridge from that concept where we understand this to those policies? I'm just like that, like, you know, like, look, I think your message is, you know, I think a lot of the people who listen to this are amenable to it. But turns out there's a lot more people outside of this audience.
Terrible, dreadful.
Yeah, I know. But what is the political, like, what is the political bridge? Like, is there a bridge to that from a political question?
I think there's two kind of bridges. One is that you've got to have specific policies. And actually, that's what Prosperity Without Growth, that earlier book, really did go into quite deeply. And those policies are pretty straightforward. You know, establish the limits so that you know where they are, what the limits you're working with. Fix the economics because they're broken at the moment. They're pointing in the wrong direction and incentivizing the wrong things. Change the social logic, because it assumes that we're all voracious consumers who just want more and more. And that's just not the case. That's not who we are as human beings. So that's part one, if you like. That's a set of policies that makes sense, that's coherent, that we could do, you know, on Monday, as the politicians used to ask me when I was economics commissioner. But the second part is to articulate that vision of what is that world that we want. And in that sense, you know, the lessons of the pandemic are quite profound, because they did focus on what really matters to us as human beings and what that vision is and what our lives could be. And that's the point where, you know, limits as the gateway to the limitless becomes incredibly important. If we take that seriously and we teach it to our kids and we teach ourselves the skills to meet the challenges that we face, then that richer world of more fulfillment, more meaning, more purpose, more involvement, this sense of being involved in a task so deeply that, you know, you're lost to the rest of the world, can be the most fulfilling place, actually, that we can find as human beings. And the psychology shows that very clearly, that the sort of placid place when we're sat on the sofas consuming junk food, watching television hour after hour, this is not a place where happiness lies. And happiness, however it's defined, we can meet that. We can find that in this sense of human fulfillment. It's a vision, if you like, of not just social progress, but the ability of ordinary people everywhere, irrespective of class or race or color or income or background, to be able to achieve more in their lives and to be more fulfilled as a result. And I firmly believe that's available to us, that world, that life after capitalism.
Tim Jackson, the book is Post-Growth, Life After Capitalism. Thanks so much for your time today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Sam.
All right, folks, quick break, and then we will wrap this up. All right, folks, that's it for us today. Tune in tomorrow. We're going to be talking to Mark Joseph Stern from Slate about some of the most recent Supreme Court rulings, some very important ones. We are beginning to see the implications of a 6-3 court in ways that perhaps you would not feel unless that you have maybe a claim against a corporation, or the desire to allow for unionization, or maybe down the road, the ability of the government to regulate corporations. We will talk more about that tomorrow. If you're watching us on Peacock, we will see you then. And if you're not watching us on Peacock, as I know many of you are not, we'll see you now. Hello. We're going to head into the fun half. You here, Matt?
Yes, I'm here.
I just want, I saw you really wanted, you went for the mic. We got to get that mic stand because we need to go for the bike. I'm like, okay, let's hear it.
Yeah, it does feel a lot more assertive when I pick up the microphone.
And it's like, whoa, I'm just like backing off a little bit. We're back in the studio. We're just like sort of easing into it. We're going to reintroduce like different systems in which we do it. It's going to take a little while. And because of the second hour we do on Peacock, there'll be times I'll be piped into studio because we need that second studio to produce all the content that we produce out of this worldwide conglomerate, I guess, of what we are. But the big question is going to be, you know, can we get to a vision of what Tim Jackson's talking about on this side of, you know, the apocalypse, essentially, is really what the question is, right? And not a bad thing to have a strong sense of what to do in a crisis. It would be nice if we could get there to as a way of averting the crisis.
Yeah, it'd be nice for post-growth to happen because we decided on it and not because the sun got too hot and started burning the land.
COVID was, in many respects, sort of a good, like, I don't know, trial run. I don't know if I would call it a boot camp as the perfect analogy, but a trial run of what it's conceivable things could be in a, you know, as climate change progresses, that we are inhibited in our ability to do things. And how we react to that inhibition and that limit, that could go a bunch of different ways, right? I mean, we saw it in the context of COVID. Some people gained a greater appreciation for what other people do in terms of how they contribute to society. Some people found, like, I like the idea of not going into work, or I'm not going back to that job I had because it's not worth it. There's more value in me being with my family. And then other people were like, I'm going to take some guns and storm a Capitol building in Oregon or Michigan and force them to completely ignore what's going on because I have to wear a mask and I don't like that.
Or you stock up your second fridge with ice cream.
Or you go and you just like the, you know, you really go back and reevaluate your ice cream flavor situation. I mean, that's also a very good example, right? That's like Peter Thiel down in New Zealand or something. That's the metaphor there. The guys who are looking
in by getting back into Captain Crunch.
Right. I mean, it also could be the Pelosi's going down there too. I mean, let's be clear. I don't know if they're going to New Zealand or what, but that's that. We're going to head into the fun half of the program. Just a reminder, it is your support that makes the show possible. Also, check out Nomi's show. I think they have now officially moved to 2 days a week. You can find it at youtube.com/TheNomiKeyShow, twitch.tv/the_NomiKey_show. We missed her yesterday on this program because we had no internet. That was unpleasant. Meanwhile, Matt still has internet at his house.
Internet was working great last night. I streamed Resident Evil Village at 1080p, 60 frames per second over at twitch.tv/literary.
Do a lot of people go like, oh, man, I freaking missed the 60 frame per second stream last night.
People ask, they wonder what video card I have and stuff like that, and I tell them. But if you want to know, you have to join one of the streams. I'll probably do another one on Thursday. I played Resident Evil. Scary game until I realized I was on casual difficulty, and then it was pretty easy to take out the zombies, and I didn't have to be afraid of them. But great atmosphere, so I'll probably, Thursday night I'll do another one of those. Also, patrons, patreon.com/leftreckoning, we had a conversation with Megan Day, released on Monday evening, about a socialist sort of utopian college in Arkansas in the 20s and 30s, a sort of Debsian influenced. And what happened to that project. So check that out, patreon.com/leftreckoning.
Incidentally, COVID, I think, up by 35% over the past week in Arkansas. There's a couple of states that are like that. Most places falling, but if you look at the vaccination rates, some places that are jumping, particularly with the Delta variant.
I still know some unvaccinated North Dakota people, and I wish they would get vaccinated.
We will have on this program, we're trying to get an epidemiologist on. We'll talk about the Delta variant, put it in context. If you are vaccinated, it is not as scary as I think maybe one would believe. But the fear, of course, is that children under the age of 12, there is no vaccine for them. And it is like, you know, one of those things, you know, water finds the lowest level. The infection works like this, too. But all right, we're going to take some phone calls. 646-257-3920 is the phone number to be part of this program. We will also take your IMs, which you could do boom, boom, on the app, majorityapp.com, and log in. IM the show. Say all sorts of mean things to me. That's okay. I understand. I am here to help. If that makes you feel better, then by all means. We will see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Are you ready?
Oh, no. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, back, back. Boy is back, and the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back, and the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar! What a fucking nightmare!
Nightmare.
Bring back DJ Dinner.
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
You see, white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay, I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
Lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan. By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on. What? Come on. What? Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy. 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 Pussy.